Thank you, Catherine, for that. As my 20-year-old daughter says, so, Professor, what are you going to profess this week? Well, I think I need to begin by offering you an apology. If you find my delivery a bit sort of wandering as I speak to you this morning, it's the person to blame is my good friend Admiral Chris Barry, and we had dinner with Malcolm Kinnaird last night. My memory, Chris, is that at about 10 o'clock, Malcolm said he had to go home, but that we were to order red wine up at a very good restaurant on his account, which we did. Hence the fragile nature of my speech this morning. My particular chapter looks at why do we need a defence industry development strategy or policy. Why do we need one? I think the answer is simple. As the Minister observed at the industry policy round table in Sydney in May, which I attended, the answer is because we don't have one at present. There's a sense of drift in industry policy. And my paper catalogues at some length previous attempts, some of which the Minister mentioned this morning, that have all failed. In my view, without exception. In my personal experience, I was involved with the previous government in 1992 when Parliamentary Secretary Roger Price, who worked for the then Defence Minister Robert Ray, attempted to develop an industry policy, and I recall 14 years ago writing a document which was published urging that we needed a strategic approach to defence industry. So you can see how I've wasted my time in the last 14 years. Secondly, again, as the Minister mentioned this morning, Bronwyn Bishop, I think in 1998, developed, I think, some profoundly good principles for defence industry policy, including expectations of ownership, investment, how foreign companies should be involved, as well as local companies in Australia. The Bronwyn Bishop rules, I think, were innovative and useful, and what did the department go and do? Well, they bureaucratically developed 49 administrative bureaucratic processes to implement the Bronwyn Bishop rules. And I remember Peter Reith, when he became minister in 2001, calling me into his office in the presence of the then Undersecretary for Acquisition, Mick Roach, and saying to me, "Mick, you're just practicing bureaucratic obfuscation. Who's interested in 49 bureaucratic steps of implementation?" And he said in front of Roach, "I'm going to ask Paul Dibb to write a major speech for me for the Defence and Industry Conference in June 2001, which I did, and then he asked me to have a major hand in writing the Cabinet submission, which went through Cabinet in November 2001, and that Cabinet submission called for more of a strategic approach to defence industry policy. And by the way, in that Cabinet submission, I used, I think, at least three times, maybe four, the word monopsony to describe defence, which I think had some ministers reaching for their dictionary. Well, what happened with the Reef Cabinet submission, which, by the way, became part of the Liberal Party's re-election platform that year? And you can read it in the Liberal Party's re-election platform in 2001. What happened to it? Nothing. Except the department took hold of it and, in a sort of Soviet central planning methodology, developed sector plans. Huge documents, very interesting, very informative. And the first fatality, of course, was the recommendation to be one shipbuilder in Australia. The aerospace one was moderately interesting. The most interesting one, I think, was the electronics sector plan, which is still part of policy and does identify for the first time some priorities. From memory, radar, sonar, mobile communications, and so on. Systems integration skills. The land and weapons sector plan still ain't seen the light of day, 5 years later. So it's a bit of a sorry history. The minister in our meeting in Sydney that I referred to earlier said, and I quote, "Precedent must not diminish our confidence or take away the need for leadership in this area." Well, amen to that. And I think I'm greatly heartened by the strength of this minister, both intellectually and in terms of his purpose with regard to defence. I think, if I might say so, the previous minister, who had a great deal of interest in the foreign policy aspects of defence policy, and he had plenty on his plate, don't get me wrong, let a number of things drift. Financial accountability in defence as one, and the other one was no leadership on industry policy. That is not to say that Senator Hill, when he was minister, didn't bounce submissions back through the second pass process to ask what the industry implications were. But that was on a case by case. That ain't policy. Policy, you need an overarching sense of principles and judgments to carry you ahead. You don't react case by case. You can argue that perhaps Peter Reith and my assistance to him was a bit too ambitious politically. My sense is that this minister will not go down the Reith path. He's a firm believer, as you heard, in competition. None of us, in my view, want to go down the sector plan of heavy intervention. But we can't pretend that defence is not the monopsonist, the sole source buyer. We can't pretend that every dollar that of the $19 billion that defence spends willy-nilly determines the size, shape, and future capabilities of defence industry. Of course it does. And therefore defence has a responsibility, it seems to me. I think if there's still any bureaucratic resistance, and I detect in the DMO and David Hurley's capability area that we've got new brooms in the department that will overcome bureaucratic resistance. And I have to say my old area, the strategic policy area, needs to get its finger out and become part of the advice on strategic priorities for defence industry. They can't wash their hands of that. Several years ago, when Brad Smith was the chief defence scientist, he found that the old area that he and I worked in, strategic policy, wouldn't help him to develop as chief defence scientist strategic priorities for enabling R&D. And Brad came to me at the university with one of his senior staff and said, "Can you do it?" Which we did, and Brad implemented it. So, you know, it can be done. Industry also is not without its problems, if I might say so, and in the last 15 years, I've come to know most, if not all, of the major defence companies. They are naturally intensely competitive, sometimes almost destructively so. It's big money, it's big tendering costs, huge tendering costs. 20, 30, 50 million and more. And if you lose, you've got to claw that back somewhere down the next project. And secondly, and Catherine, I endorse your idea of a defence industry policy council, but there's got to be some rules of engagement. Defence needs to understand that many, if not all, defence companies are frightened of the department. Why? It's a monopsony. It's got the big stick. And that inhibits frank discussion, seems to me. There are some senior people in the department who ask the question to me, what's the difference between defence industry and, quote, the steel industry or the motor car industry? Well, I would have thought Blind Freddy can see the difference. It's called the national interest. We're not making motor cars or soap powder. We're making things that, as Chris Berry spells out very clearly in his chapter, is crucial to the operations of the ADF. We are not talking here, and let me stress this very clearly, about subsidising industry. We need a set of strategic priorities because the marketplace may not leave the defence force with the capabilities it needs in both peace and war. And that's self-evident, it seems to me. And secondly, we need to think much more clearly about the independence of ADF operations to support Australian sovereignty. That's not a call for self-sufficiency or walking away from the alliance, But it's called the national interest. Any self-respecting government, in my view, had better think about those areas when push comes to shove. We need to be able to support independent ADF operations. And obviously, the difference between the steel industry and the motor car industry and defence industry is not only that, it is the imperfect nature of the market, the monopsony factor. Having said that, and Steve Gumley points this out carefully to me, and I respect his judgment on this, industry too has certain, if you like the phrase, oligopolistic characteristics. In most sectors of defence industry, there are two or three, generally two, sometimes three, major primes who dominate the market share. And Steve would go further and say, while he's doing, in my view, an excellent job about fostering competition and looking at schedule and getting things back on the rails, once a large contract has been let to a major prime, defence is very much in the hands of that company. If things go badly wrong, are you actually going to really junk $1.2 billion worth of helicopters and start again? Well, I doubt it. And that leads to certain lack of flexibility in the relationship. The key issue, in my view, is that we need a set of strategic priorities for defence industry. I know it's easier to say than to do. It won't be easy to do. It involves David's people, my old strategic policy area, and the DMO. It is not only the DMO responsibility. And that's why this public discussion paper, which Mark Thompson is a member of, is so very important, and the shape and recommendations that the Minister will take to Cabinet, hopefully later this year. You've heard me say, and I want to stress it again, if we don't do this project, then the marketplace may not deliver what is critical for ADF warfighting and its support. In terms of strategic priorities, as I think I said on ABC Radio yesterday, one of the benchmarks is for Australia to maintain a technological edge relative to our region. It's not to identify any particular country as a threat. It is a long-held policy over successive governments since at least the 1976 White Paper that we have a technological edge. Why? We're a small defence force, 50-odd thousand. We're a small population, which even by the middle of this century in 2050 is going to be struggling to reach 28 million when countries to our north, again, not to look at threats, just to observe our decreasing strategic throw weight in the region. Countries to our north, Indonesia by 2050, it'll be 320 million. China, India, you know that. There'll be lots of countries over 100 million. Philippines, Thailand, and so on. And although our economy may well continue to be dynamic because of what John Howard calls us being an energy superpower, these population characteristics will mean that we'll need to work harder on maintaining a technological leading edge. And it shouldn't be beyond the wit to look at that technology trends. We know what sort of countries are going to supply weapons into the region. We know it very well. And it shouldn't be too difficult to benchmark that. We might have to look at, and we've tried this before and it hasn't happened, to link certain like-minded technology capabilities in the DCP to get to smooth out the workload. Again, not to subsidise, but to give some more, if you like, predictability about workflow in crucial areas. And you know, my view is the experience of other countries, as different as the United States, the United Kingdom and Sweden, is they don't just leave it to the marketplace. Who believes that the Americans leave it all to the marketplace? Oh, really? Or the Brits? And Sweden, a country half our size, has a defence company, Saab International, not the motor car maker, the arms manufacturer, that employs, some tell, 13,000 people and has a turnover of 2.5 billion US, 60% of which is exported. How come a country half our size is able to do that? The minister said, and I quote, "It is an industry like no other." I think, and you heard him say it, and let me remind you what he said, he has four new priority areas, the minister, and he articulated these at the Sydney Roundtable on the 17th of May. First, he wants to ensure an industry capability that can be sustained and to identify the key capabilities the ADF must have for defence self-reliance. Second, he strongly believes in the importance of the regional impact of defence spending. And he observes, and you heard him say it, that state governments are the significant investors in defence infrastructure, not the companies, and there's an issue there. Third, he believes, and you heard him say it again, that the time is right to review the role of the SMEs. They're critical for innovation. And fourth, he wants to seriously improve Australia's defence export performance and our access to global supply chains. That's probably one of the few areas where I've got a problem. We have no good track record on defence exports, except in a few small areas. And we have a poor track record in terms of the role of the Department of Defence in not being particularly interested in defence exports. The model, frankly, is DESO, the British Defence Export Services Organisation, a highly professional, tough-minded bunch of people in which the defence attachés of the United Kingdom overseas see as their prime job the sale of arms, not some dirty thing that they'd rather go and play golf instead of. And by the way, my observation is that DESO shares highly sensitive intelligence with defence companies. We don't. So there needs to be some lateral thinking here. So my view is that defence needs to be much better at aligning industry capability with defence strategy. By the way, not aligning defence strategy with industry capability. You notice the difference? We require a defence industry development strategy that identifies those indigenous industrial capabilities needed to ensure national security, as I've argued. And equally, as Mike Thompson, I think, would argue, it should specify those that can be met by the international market. This is not some subsidisation scheme. It's not a return to subsidies by stealth. But the fact that defence is a monopsony means that it effectively determines the future shape and size of defence industry, as you've heard me argue. The changes I envisage will demand much more of a strategic approach to industry from defence. They'll also, quite frankly, require a more discerning approach from industry about what is important when it comes to future investment and equally, what is not. Defining the link between defence strategy and what is required from industry, you've heard me stress, has been a perennial problem. It has failed time after time with the best of intentions. Bronwyn Bishop, Peter Reith, and now this term round. It's about time it was resolved, it seems to me. If defence does not make clear which industrial capabilities Australia needs, then industry will make its own independent decisions. And they can't be blamed for that. And those local capabilities that are required to maintain our leading technological edge in the region may just disappear. That, let me stress, should it occur, will constrain the choices about how we use the defence force in the future. And that is the central issue. And if I leave you with one thought, it's that. So, my call is for much greater clarity about which capabilities should be maintained onshore and those that can be met from the wider market overseas. In the case of the United Kingdom, December last year, white paper on industry capabilities, which I commend to you, it's a long document, but do nothing else but read the executive summary, it's worthwhile. The Brits have looked at their industry sector by sector. Fully more than half of the document is looking at sector by sector, and it names companies. It says, for example, British Aerospace, you ain't going to be making combat aircraft in future, but you are going to be doing this, this, and this, and this is what we expect of you. And it also named some of the foreign companies. Thales, and I think from memory, Raytheon. Now, I know there's differences of scale between British defence industry and ours. There's differences of defence spending. So I'm not saying one size suits all and that you just take the British white paper and shrink wrap it. No. But the general philosophy that it uses is well worth looking at. Now, having said that, let me be very blunt. What I'm recommending, I know, is at odds with dominant models in Canberra these days of so-called good public policy practice. That's called competition at any price. Does the Treasury or Finance like what I have to say? No. Does the Secretary of the Department of Industry, who was at our Sydney meeting, like it? No. Did I tell him very bluntly in plenary session that we're not making soap powder or motor cars? And if he doesn't understand that, he should find himself another job. And yet, if we're to promote a sustainable industrial base that retains in our country those industrial capabilities needed to ensure national sovereignty, it is self-evident that we need to make clear what our priorities are and are not. Very briefly, and I'm going to close now, there are five particular policy guidelines that my paper identifies. One is to acknowledge that the next 8 to 10 years are going to be very stressful for defence industry. There's going to be plenty of work, lots of new platforms, naval, air, land. But industry needs in its corporate planning to think that beyond that time frame, there'll be a long period when we won't be buying new platforms. And we'll be keeping them in the order of battle longer and longer. Why? Because they're more expensive. And they'll need to think about smart ways of modifying, adapting, and upgrading. Industry should not just be about maintenance, which tends to be one of the magic mantras in the department's attitudes. Secondly, internationally, I think, and I could be wrong, we're going to see more concentration of suppliers. We've seen it in America, we've seen it in Europe, and that means, guess what? No matter what the DMO thinks about competition, we're going to have less competition in terms of our choice of suppliers. Thirdly, as the Minister and others have said, defence industry is going to be competing for very crucial, scarce skills, particularly if our economy continues to boom because of the demand effects from the enormous Chinese economy. And we certainly need to do something about working together with industry and the tertiary sector, and I know this state of South Australia is doing it, about developing crucial skill sets, and not least systems integration skills and software skills, which have been the Achilles heel of project after project. Combat system of the Collins submarine, the original one, the original Telstra project on over the horizon radar, the integration of the Penguin missile on the Sea Sprite, you can name them time after time. These are crucial problems that need resolving. Fourthly, I think we need to be tougher about negotiating access to overseas technology. We get good access from both American and European suppliers. I'm a great supporter of the American alliance. It's clear that lots of American defence companies are leading edge. They're not the only ones. Sometimes the Europeans can develop things like helicopters more imaginatively, more cost effectively. But the DMO needs to get tough with the Americans about things like source code release. And if you think that's some academic theory, let me tell you, when I was Deputy Secretary of Defence, and we'd had the F-18s for 5 years, and I was chairing the Force Structure Committee with Brad at my right-hand side, the Air Force told us that the ATG-65 radar could recognise every Soviet fighter aircraft known to God and no Blue Force aircraft. No A4s, F5s, any of that. And the then Secretary of Defence, Tony Ayres, sent me to Washington to talk to the Undersecretary of Defence in the Pentagon, one Paul Wolfowitz. See how things don't change? You know what he said? About Paul? Paul, he said to me, "You're our closest ally in the Asia-Pacific region. Of course you'll get the source code." We're still waiting. And that isn't, you know, I mean, and look, I know these are very sensitive issues, even for the closest of allies. We shouldn't just trawl for source code. That's overambitious. But if we're to have any sense of sovereignty and self-reliance, key aspects of source code, from whatever source, whether it's American or European, should be part of the negotiation. And the fifth and final message is the one I won't bore you with again. It's building the right capabilities that reflect our unique circumstances. So, a couple of final points. We need, and I hate the phrase, a whole-of-government approach from defence, or as Brad would call it, a whole-of-wholeness approach, to this issue of defence industry policy. It should not just be left to the industry policy division in the DMO. Lieutenant General Hurley's capability staff should and are being involved. I've read a paper that comes from one of his senior staff, which is not public at present, called Critical Industry Capabilities 2015-2030. It needs a fair amount of more work. It should not just be a litany of U-Butte technologies that we need. It needs some strategic guidance. But the fact they're doing it is important. I think from industry, you've heard me say that I think Catherine's idea of an industry council is good. We need more frankness from industry. I know you hate each other and you want to slit each other's throats, but we need more frankness from industry. Some companies need better corporate planning about the future of defence industry policy. Too many companies, for reasons I understand of cash flow, get straight down into the defence capability plan and what widget they want to sell. If you don't operate within some concept of where defence is going, you're going to make some bad investment decisions. And what we need from government is what the new minister is so imaginatively embarked on, and we should give him every bit of support. Let me stress, we're not intervening in the market for the benefit of defence industry. We want to mildly shape, not manage, shape the defence industry sector for the benefit of the Australian Defence Force and the national interests in an independent Australian sovereign way. Finally, can I thank CEDA and especially Ian Marsh and David? I remember you coming to my office about a year ago and we gave birth to this child. We discussed who we would bring on board. A little bit of advertisement from me, if you like. Four of the nine contributors are from the Australian National University, whose new chancellor, by the way, is Dr. Alan Hawke, the former Secretary of Defence. We've got the old team back together. Hugh White, me, Admiral Barry, Brad Smith, Alan Hawke, we're cooking. And we ain't got a lot of competition, believe you me. I suppose we're a sort of monopsony, are we? And I think the timing, if I might say so, has been excellent. We didn't know, David, when we talked about this late last year and got the contributors together and said, March, we want your draft. We didn't know there'd be a new minister, because the previous minister was not interested in what we're doing, in my view. Not deeply interested anyway. And we didn't know that there would be a public discussion paper. And I think it's been serendipity that we've released this just at the right time. And can I just, very final word, it's a beautiful publication, and I've been really impressed with the speed and the quality of the publication, and I just wish universities, including mine, could have the efficiency of CEDA in the publications process. Thank you.